Chapter 18. Utah is included between the 37th and 42nd parallels of north latitude and meridians 109 and 114 west from Greenwich. Deducting, however, from the northeast corner a section of 1 degree of latitude by 2 of longitude, lately attached to Wyoming. Its greatest length is thus from north to south 5 full degrees, and its width from east to west 5 of the shorter meridional degrees. The whole area divided nearly equally between 2 geographical sections, viz., the valley and drainage of the Colorado and its affluents, the Green and Grand Rivers, and the district known as the Great, or Interior Basin. This remarkable section, containing the western half of Utah, all of Nevada, and a part of southeastern California, includes all that portion of the continent extending north and south between the parallels 37 and 42, and from east to west from near the meridian 111, Greenwich, to the Sierra Nevadas, which tend northwesterly from the meridian of 116 to that of 121, an irregular parallelogram 400 miles in extent, from north to south, and 500 miles from east to west. The term basin is only applicable to the whole tract in view of the fact that its waters have no outlet to the ocean, for the general level of the lower tracts is as high as average mountain ranges, and the so-called valleys are little more than mountain flats. The entire section is thus composed of a succession of heights, basins, and mountain plateaus. A succession of basins, because many of the traverse ranges are of equal height with those on the borders, dotted also in the most level portions with detached hills and knobs, relieved at rare intervals by fertile vales, spotted again by vast deserts of sand and alkali or brackish lakes, a region now of frozen, now of fiery alps, rocks, fens, bogs, dens, and shades of death. Wherever the mountains are high enough to furnish melting snow throughout the summer, large streams flow down their sides, and fertile tracts are found along their base, caused by the percolation of moisture from above. But in general, at any great distance from the foot of the mountains, we find barrenness, and throughout the Great Basin, a large tract without mountains is invariably a desert. Most of the mountain streams sink before connecting with any other body of water, in many places among the foothills before reaching the plain. Others spread out and supply natural irrigation to a mile or two of land, producing broad savannas of coarse, rank grass, little oases, quite attractive in themselves and delightful in comparison with the sterility beyond. Along the foot of some ranges, the traveler every mile or so crosses a considerable stream, rushing clear and strong from the mountain hollows, but 2 or 3 miles down the plain, not a channel or trace of water is to be found, the thirsty soil, warm sun, and drying air having exhausted the scant liquid, and it is only in very wet seasons that any of these streams form lakes. In other localities, a more plentiful supply and the cool shadow of long ranges give rise to streams of sufficient size to be called rivers, of which the best known in Utah are the Jordan, Bear River, Sevier, Ogden, and Weber. And bordering these larger streams are valleys of great fertility, comprising the agricultural wealth of the territory. Many of the smaller streams form long, shallow lagoons or marshes near the centers or at the points of lowest depression in the basins, generally called sinks, in which term is embodied an empirical explanation of the disappearance of the water by those ignorant of the fact that in nature's laboratory action and reaction are equal, and that the fall of rain and snow in an enclosed basin must be exactly counterbalanced by evaporation. In most cases, the water supply is so scant that these sinks become entirely dry in summer and are then known as mudflats, of which the most extensive are in western Nevada. A smaller number contain some water all the year, of which a few rise to the dignity of lakes. With no outlets and receiving all the chemical material brought down by the wash of their feeders, they are of necessity either very saline in character or brackish and impregnated with iron. Throughout the Great Basin, certain general features are observable. The mountain ranges mostly run north and south, and the longer valleys lie in the same direction. But in this particular man has not been able to accommodate himself to nature, and the course of civilization as well as empire has made it necessary for the roads to run east and west. One may go from Montana to Arizona and travel in valleys nearly all the way, seldom crossing anything more than a low divide, but from east to west, each range must be crossed at certain points, for which cause the old road south of the lake was a perfect zigzag, selecting the most feasible valleys, avoiding the mountains wherever possible, or canyoning up one side and down the other, diverging great distances from the direct line, and running to almost every point of the compass. The rim of the basin is uncontinuous, formed by various ranges. On the north are the broken chains of the Oregon system, from 8,000 to 10,000 feet high, sending out many spurs and traverse ridges. On the western border, the Sierra Nevadas average 10,000 feet, and some peaks tower far above that altitude. On the south are the lower sub-ranges of the Rocky Mountains, mere divides, separating the waters of the basin from those of the Colorado, and on the east is the main Uinta Range, known by various names, with several portions rising to 9,000 or 10,000 feet. Thus, the surface configuration of Utah is a great depression in a mountain land, a trough, so to speak, elevated 4,000 or 5,000 feet above sea level, subtended on all sides by mountain ranges 8,000 to 10,000 feet high, and subdivided by transverse ranges. In the geologic age, a sweet water inland sea, in Aboriginal times, the home of the most abject savages, long a region of misconception and fable, then the chosen home of a strange religion, and but yesterday found to be of use and interest to the civilized world. Leaving the mountain ranges which bound the Great Basin, there is a general breaking down, so to speak, towards the interior. Most of the transverse ranges run north and south, terminating in bold headlands towards the south, though none are of sufficient length and continuous height to constitute a well-defined system. Few of these ridges present regular slopes, but are formed of acute and angular cappings, superimposed upon flatter prisms. And frequently after ascending two-thirds from the base, the upper part becomes wall-like and insurmountable. Of these interior peaks, or terminal headlands, the most noted are the Twin Peaks, southeast of Salt Lake City, ascertained by Orson Pratt and Albert Carrington to be 11,660 feet in height, Mount Nebo, 8,000 feet, the Wasatch Spur near Salt Lake City averaging 6,000 feet, and the Oquirrh Range, which terminates in a bold headland at the south end of the lake, locally known as the West Mountain, lying 20 miles west of Salt Lake City. The Salt Lake Basin, including many adjacent and connecting valleys, was evidently an inland sea, as shown by the bench formation, a system of watermarks along the mountains, points of successive subsidence of the waters, while many of the detached mountain peaks were as evidently islands, similar to those now rising above the surface of the lake. According to some, the dry land was formed by successive upheavals, according to others, by ages of evaporation. If the latter theory be correct, it must have been through a dry cycle of many thousand years. And if, as many suppose, the dry cycle has ended and the rain zones are changing so as to again include this section, we may look for a still greater rise in the lake surface than that of the last dozen years. The river system of Utah is curious, but unimportant as to navigation. The noted Jordan, an exact counterpart of its eastern namesake, has its origin in Utah Lake, and by a course of 50 miles, a little west of north, discharges the surplus waters of that body into Great Salt Lake. It is quite evident, however, from mere inspection, that a much greater quantity of water is poured into Utah Lake from its many mountain affluents than flows out through the Jordan. A small portion may escape by percolation, but at that elevation and in that drying air, more is accounted for by evaporation. This stream has an average width of 8 or 10 rods. Through the upper part of its course and in Jordan Canyon, it is swift and shallow. In the lower valley and near the city, more sluggish, with a depth of 10 feet or more. Passing around the lake eastwardly, the next stream of any note is Kay's Creek, furnishing plentiful irrigation to the farms of Kay's Ward, besides which there are numerous streams of smaller size which break out of the Wasatch Range, are diverted into irrigating canals, and by 1,000 rills through the farms find their way to the marshy lands near the lake. The main stream from the east is the Weber, which has its rise some 60 miles east of Salt Lake City, in the highest valley of Summit County. Thence flowing to the north is swelled by the waters of East Branch, Silver, White, Clay, and Echo Creeks. Then turning northwest, breaks through the Wasatch Range, gives form and name to Weber Canyon, enters the valley 33 miles north of Salt Lake City, and forming a large U with the bend sharply to the north, enters the lake. Bear River rises in the same county, and but a little east and north of the Weber, and running nearly 200 miles down a northern slope between two spurs of the Uinta Mountains, forms a great U in Idaho. Then turning southwest, canyons through another spur of the Uinta into Cache Valley, the northeastern section of the territory and home of 12,000 Mormons. Then canyons downward 3 miles with a fall of 1,000 feet out of Cache into Bear River Valley, through which it runs to the head of Bear River Bay, the last 20 miles of its course the only navigable river in Utah. From the mouth of Bear River Canyon to the head of the bay is about 35 miles in a direct line, the valley maintaining an average width of 15 miles down to Corinn, where it widens imperceptibly into Salt Lake Valley. Bear River runs through the finest lumber region in Utah, of which it is the natural outlet, and many thousand logs have already been sent down to Corinn, where a sawmill and sash factory are now in operation. The Malad joins Bear River a few miles above Corinn, between which place and the promontory there are a few springs breaking out of the mountains, constituting but one stream large enough to have a name, Blue Creek. West of the promontory, a few springs run together in the midst of a horrible desert and form Indian Creek, which sometimes reaches the lake in wet seasons. Thence, around the head of the lake and down the entire western shore, for 100 miles, there is no stream large enough to have a name, and but one furnishing running water in all seasons. On the southwest, a small creek from Tooele Valley reaches the lake, completing the list of affluents to that body. Next in importance are the feeders of Utah Lake, of which the principal are Salt Creek from the south, Spanish Fork from the east, and Timpanogos from the northeast, which, with the addition of several smaller streams, furnish at least twice as much water to that gem of the desert as the Jordan carries off. The only other stream of any importance is the Sevier River, which rises near the southern boundary of Utah. In Fish Lake, runs 150 miles to the north, then bends to the west around the point of Iron Mountain, receiving the small supplies of Salt Creek, San Pete, Chicken Creek, and Meadow Creek, then, taking a southwest course, is lost in the big sink of Sevier Lake Desert. West of the Iron Mountain Range are a score of sinking creeks, among them Pioneer, Chalk, Cove, and Corn Creeks, which are fed by the melting snows of the mountains, furnish scant irrigation to a small strip of land, and are lost in the great desert of southwestern Utah. Below the divide, the only streams of note are the Rio Virgen and its affluents, which belong to the Colorado system. Most of the larger streams abound in fish, among which mountain trout are particularly worthy of note. Their waters, on issuing from hills, are of great clearness and purity, and it is only where small streams have run some distance across the plain that they are, in local phrase, alkalied. The rivers depend for their existence upon the mountains, and without those gorges, which supply melted snow during the spring and summer, there would be no running water. Next to the sinking rivers of Utah, the thermal and chemical springs constitute a remarkable feature. They are found in almost every part of the territory, but principally along the road from Salt Lake City northward. All along the foothills of the Promontory Range, in the mountains southwest of Utah Lake, and between the city and Bear River are fountains of strong brine, discharging in many instances large volumes of water. There are sulfurous pools at the southern extremity of Salt Lake Valley. In one of the islands in the lake are springs of every character, and in places along the Wasatch, Hot, Cold, and Chalabet are found side by side. First in fame, and probably in medical value, are the warm springs in Salt Lake City. Issuing in large volume from the mountainside, the water is conveyed in pipes to a regular bathing house on one side and to a plunge pool on the other, constituting, in my opinion, the most praiseworthy of Mormon institutions. The following analysis is by Dr. Gale, assistant of Captain Stanbury in 1850. 100 parts of the water, whose specific gravity was 7.112, gave solid contents of 1.068087, divided as follows: sulfuretted hydrogen, 0.038182, carbonate of lime, 0.07500, carbonate of magnesia, 0.02270, chloride of calcium, 0.0570, sulfate of soda, 0.064835, chloride of sodium, 0.866, total 1,068,087. The usual temperature is 102 degrees. 3 miles north of the city, the hot springs boil out from a rock at the foot of the mountain, forming a hot pool 2 or 3 rods in circumference, whence the branch runs westward and forms the Hot Spring Lake, a body of sulfurous water some 2 miles long and about half as wide, having an outlet into the Jordan. At several places around the margin of this singular lake, small jets of hot water boil up with great force. The air in the neighborhood is loaded with the vapors, and immediately over the spring is almost stifling. Gazing into the small pool formed by the spring, the eye is charmed by the variety of fanciful growths, the confervae on the rocky bottom. Every conceivable form of vegetation is to be seen, leaves, plants, flowers, and fern-like stems, all of the purest emerald. But all are deceptions, mere imitations of plants formed by the chemical material on the points of stone. The temperature of this spring is 128 degrees, its specific gravity 1.0130, and 100 parts yield solid contents 1.0602, divided according to Dr. Gale as follows: chloride of sodium, 0.8052, chloride of magnesia, 0.288, chloride of calcium, 0.1096, sulfate of lime, 0.0806, carbonate of lime, 0.0180, silica, 0.0180. Total 1.0602. The most noted mineral springs are 70 miles north of Salt Lake City, near the north crossing of Bear River. They are hot and cold, impregnated with iron or with sulfur, some 20 in number, and all rising within a few feet of each other. 3 springs, the first very hot and sulfurous, the second moderately warm and tasting of iron, the third of cold, pure water, rise within a space of 3 feet. The waters, all flowing into the same channel, do not mix at once, but run apparently in separate strata for several hundred yards. The hot metallic water often running under the clear, cold water, nor is it until the sudden bends in the channel have thrown the streams violently from side to side that they mingle in a fluid of uniform temperature. South of Salt Lake City, along the Jordan, are found hot pools which send out very little water, and in other places are chalybeate springs, coating the earth and rocks with oxide of iron. There are also chemical springs on one or two of the islands in the lake. The great salt beds of the basin are in Nevada, but in southern Utah is a peak known as the Salt Mountain, from which that mineral can be cut in solid blocks in its pure crystallized state. Of the mudflats impregnated with soda and the alkali deposits, there is a decided surplus, particularly as man has been unable to devise any use for such a quantity of those chemicals in that shape. It is thought the presence of alkali increases the cold, nor does it seem possible to eradicate it from the soil. A slight admixture is thought to be beneficial to vegetation, but wherever there is enough to flower out upon the surface, it is death to all vegetation, even the hardy sagebrush. Saltpeter is found, though rarely. Sulfur is rather too common. Borax is found in moderate amount. Petroleum has lately been discovered in paying quantities, and the native alum was analyzed and pronounced good by Dr. Gale. From his report, 100 grams of the freshly crystallized salt gave water, 70.3, protoxide of manganese, 0.8 alumina, 0.4 sulfuric acid, 18.0 of the vast chemical wealth of the territory, but little is known, and next to nothing has been utilized. But in a general view, the entire basin seems a vast laboratory of nature, where all the primitive processes have been carried out on a scale so extensive as to make man's dominion, at first sight, seem forever impossible. First in interest among the large bodies of water is the Great Salt Lake, the Dead Sea of America, which lies toward the northwest corner of Utah Territory, 4,200 feet above sea level, and 12 miles at the nearest point from Salt Lake City. It is in the form of an irregular parallelogram, of which the major axis running northwest by north is 70 miles in length, and the minor axis 40 miles. The different projections, however, greatly increase the area, which is laid down by Captain Stansbury at 90 by 40 miles in round numbers. The first mention in history of this wonderful lake is by Baron Honton, French governor of Newfoundland, who made a voyage west of the Mississippi in the year 1690, and sailed for 6 weeks up a river, probably the Missouri, according to his description. Here he found a nation of Indians called the Naxitars, probably one of the now extinct Mandan tribes. These Indians brought to him four captives of a nation, far to the west, whom they called Mozimleks, of whom the Baron says, "The Mozimlek nation is numerous and puissant. These four captives informed me that at a distance of 150 leagues from where I then was, their principal river empties itself into a salt lake of 300 leagues in circumference, the mouth of which is 2 leagues broad. That there are 100 towns, great and small, around that sort of sea, and upon it they navigate with such boats as you see drawn on the map, which map the Mozimlek people drew me on the bark of trees, that the people of that country made stuffs, copper axes, and several other manufactures which the Outagamis and other interpreters could not give me to understand as being altogether unacquainted with such things, etc., etc., etc. These captives may have been of the Ute Nation, or more probably the semi-civilized races of Mexico had colonies there at that time, as indicated by the ruins found south of the lake. The next mention of the lake is in a work published in America in 1772-1727 entitled A Description of the Province of Carolina by the Spaniards called Florida and by the French called Louisiane, in which are recited the native accounts of a lake many leagues west of the mountains, in which there is no living creature, but around its shore the spirits inhabit in great vapors, and out of that lake a great river disembogues into the South Sea. The spirits will be readily recognized in the hot springs, but it is singular that both accounts should give the lake an outlet. Not long afterwards, the lake became well known to hunters and trappers, and in 1845, Colonel Fremont, then on his second expedition, made a sort of flying survey, which was scientifically completed in 1849-50 by Captain Howard Stansbury. In geologic ages, the lake was doubtless an inland sea, which has declined to its present limits, but it is singular that since Stansbury's survey, the lake surface has risen at least 12 feet, of which 8 feet were gained in the years 1865, 66, and 67. The natural result has been to greatly weaken the saline character of the water. There is a widespread misapprehension on this subject, it being customary for Eastern lecturers to state that 3 gallons of the water will make 1 of salt. The highest estimate, however, that by Fremont only gave 24% of salt, and the water was taken from the northwest corner, the most saline portion of the lake. Dr. Gale found 100 parts of the water to contain solid contents, 22.282 distributed as follows: chloride of sodium, common salt, 20.196 sulfate of soda, 1.834 chloride of magnesium, 0.252 chloride of calcium, a trace. Total, 22.282. But it is quite evident that an analysis at this time would show much less, probably not more than 18% of solid matter, perhaps even less in the eastern part, and not over 12 or 14% in Bear River Bay, the least saline arm of the lake. Those engaged in making salt on Spring Bay, certainly the most saline, state that in 1869 it required 6 gallons of water to make 1 of salt. Even with this reduction, it has no superior but the Dead Sea water, of which 100 parts give solid contents 24.580, while the Atlantic Ocean only averages 3.5% of its weight, or about 0.5 ounce to the pound. At the spring floods, the lake often rises several feet, and retiring in the summer leaves vast deposits of crystallized salt. In places, large bayous could easily be filled during the summer by windmills upon the lake shore, making millions of tons of salt at a trifling outlay. Considering the area of the lake, 90 by 40 miles, and its average depth 10 feet, this would give a little over 1,000 billion solid feet of water, or at the rate above mentioned, 4,800,000 tons of salt. Estimating the population of the Earth at 1,200 millions, this would be enough to supply them all, as well as domestic animals, for 1,000 years. All through the slopes northwest of the lake and down the western shore are a number of springs running pure brine, and east of the promontory, all the wells dug within 5 miles of the lake have yielded salt water at a short depth. If anyone doubts the statement that the waters of the lake are taken up by evaporation and inclines to the hypothesis of an underground outlet, he can easily convince himself by dipping a basin of the water and exposing it for a few moments to the action of sun and wind. The drying air and the direct rays of the sun will evaporate it in an incredibly short space of time. Very beautiful effects are produced by taking shrubs of dwarf oak or pine and dashing the salt water over them at intervals of a few minutes, allowing the salt to form on the leaves in thin, filmy crystals. The ingenuity of man seems in a fair way to utilize even the immense saline deposits in and near the lake. The newly discovered process of reducing native ore, in which salt is extensively used, bids fair to be generally adopted, and as there is valuable ore all over Nevada and three-fourths of Utah, the day may not be distant when we will need all of this useful preservative, which is poured out here in such profusion as to seem a waste on the part of nature. Whence comes this salt? The mountain rains and melting snows carry the washings of the salt mountains of southern Utah to Utah Lake, where they are imperceptible to the taste, but are carried down by the Jordan, united with the contributions of Bear River and the brine springs of Promontory, they are subjected to the condensing process of nature in Great Salt Lake. If there were an underground outlet, a few months' discharge, with the constant reception of fresh water, would make it as fresh as Utah Lake. Standing on the shore of Great Salt Lake, one may observe the whole process of nature in rain formation. He may see the mist from the lake rise to a certain height, then form in light fleecy clouds which sail away to the mountains, where they are caught by projecting peaks and higher currents of air, and forced into denser masses, and at times he may observe them pouring upon the heights, the water which will run back and mingle with the mass at his feet, completing thus the cycle of moisture, which Solomon remarked in the exactly similar phenomena of the Dead Sea. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place whence they came, thither the waters return. The country bordering Great Salt Lake presents almost every possible variety of soil, but little or no change in climate. First to the south lies Jordan Valley, which is generally meant when the people speak of Salt Lake Valley, 40 miles long by about 12 in breadth. All the eastern half is valuable for agriculture, and most of the western for grazing. Proceeding northward, a strip of salt marsh and low pasture land near the lake is bounded on the east by a strip of fertile land from 1 to 5 miles wide, back of which are considerable pastures, even some distance up the mountainside. The same is true of Bear River Valley and the eastern slope of the promontory, the former consisting of a fertile tract from 10 to 15 miles in width. But crossing Promontory to the west, the change is sudden, and we find at the northwest corner of the lake a valley of alkali flats and salt beds of indescribable barrenness. The entire western shore is a perfect desert, a salt and arid waste of clay and sand, of the consistency of mortar in wet weather, and a bed of stifling dust in dry. Not even the sagebrush and greasewood find life in the poisonous soil, and near the lake thousands of acres lie glistening in the sun, bare white with salt and alkali. Running water is found in but one place, and even the scant springs are separated by journeys of 50 miles. It is comfortable to reflect that a further rise of 5 feet in the lake surface would bring it upon this desert, with an area of 70 miles square to cover, and requiring at least 10 times as much water for a rise of 1 foot as it did 10 years ago. Along the shore, the atmosphere is bluish and hazy, and Captain Stansbury observes that it is a labor to use telescopes for geodetic purposes, and astronomical observations are very imperfect. In the body of the lake are several islands and projecting rocks, designated in the order of their size as follows. 1. Antelope, also called Church or Mormon Island, having been appropriated by the Corporation or Church of Latter-day Saints for their stock, a sort of consecrated cattle corral for the Lord and Brother Brigham. At the nearest point, it is about 20 miles northwest of Salt Lake City. For many years, the channel between it and the eastern shore was fordable and is still occasionally. It contains a number of green valleys and some springs of pure water. In the shape of an irregular diamond with a sharp western projection from the northern point, it is 16 miles long with an extreme width of 7 miles. It contains many ridges and detached peaks, the highest 3,000 feet above the lake and consequently 7,200 above sea level. Near the northeastern coast is a rock called Egg Island, and on the most eastern cliff they say there is a cave with remarkable blue grottos of which monstrous stories have been told. 2. Stansbury Island is the second largest in the lake, lying southwest of Antelope near the western shore, with which it is connected at rare intervals of low water by a sand spit. It is about half the size of Antelope Island and consists of a single ridge, 12 miles in length, and rising 3,000 feet above the lake. It is of some use for grazing purposes and is frequented by ducks, geese, plover, gulls, and pelicans. 3. Carrington Island, so named from the Mormon engineer Albert Carrington, who assisted Captain Stansbury in his survey, is an irregular circle with a single central peak. It contains no springs, but abounds in a great variety of plants and flowers. It lies a little northwest of Stansbury and west of the north point of Antelope Island, near the western shore. 4. Fremont Island lies between Antelope and Promontory Point, nearer the last, and just below the point where Bear River Bay opens into the central part of the lake. It is shaped somewhat like a half moon, abounds in plants, particularly the wild onion, but is destitute of wood and water. Colonel Fremont named it Disappointment Island, having been led to believe, before visiting it, that it abounded in trees and shrubbery, teeming with game of every description. Stansbury gave its present name, and it is sometimes locally known as Castle Island, suggested probably by the turreted formation of its principal peak. 5. Dolphin Island lies far up towards the northwestern corner, a mere rocky knoll. 6. Hat Island, southeast of Gunnison, and another small island in the vicinity, are probably part of the same reef. The deepest sounding in the lake, 40 feet, is found between Stansbury and Antelope Islands. The latter is also rich in minerals, marble of the finest quality and roofing slate being readily obtained in large quantities. Boats could run directly alongside of the quarries and load with the greatest convenience. A considerable boating interest will yet be built up on the lake, in which these islands will play an important part. On the eastern shores of the lake are cultivated farms, populous towns, mines of all valuable metals. On the island are valuable tracts for pasturage, and at the foot of the surrounding mountains are medicinal springs, hot and cold, sulfur, iron, and soda. The summer air of the lake is light, saline, and health-inspiring, the scenery unsurpassed, and abounding in views of memorable beauty. The romance of this Mare Mortuum has survived the investigations of science, and from a region of misconception and fable, the vicinity of the Great Salt Lake has become the Switzerland of America. Besides the noted Dead Sea, the Great Basin is well provided with lakes, such as they are, of which those in Utah constitute an irregular chain from north to south. Bear Lake, a mere tarn among the mountains, extending from Cache Valley into Idaho, is chiefly notable as the home of the Bear Lake Monster, a nondescript with a body half seal, half serpent, and a head somewhat like a sea lion, which has often been seen and described by Indians and Mormons, but never by white Christians that I have heard of. It has never been properly classified or named, as it is invisible when scientific observers are at hand, but from the descriptions current among the latter-day philosophers, I judge it to be a relic of that extinct species, generally denominated the Gynasticutus. The Sweet Water Reservoir, Utah Lake, is fed by large streams from the western slopes of the Uinta Range, its circumference exclusive of offsets, being estimated at 80 miles. This singular analog of the Sea of Galilee receives the waters from the southern mountains, containing a few grains of salt to the gallon, and after furnishing space for considerable evaporation, discharges them by way of Jordan into Great Salt Lake. Sevier, Preuss, Nicollet, and Little Salt Lake in like manner receive and furnish sinks for the waters from the Iron Mountain Range and the southern branch of the Wasatch, none of these lakes communicating with any other, but each dependent on a distinct water system. Only the larger streams form lakes, the smaller either evaporated or sink in ponds and puddles of black mire. The waters in places reappear or pass underground to feed the larger lakes. The deserts of Utah consist of alkali flats, barren sand, or red earth, resulting in most instances merely from the lack of water, for where this can be supplied in sufficient abundance, the alkali is in no long time washed away, and many of the sandy districts once thought to be irreclaimably barren have been proved quite fertile by irrigation. It is quite evident also that a change has been going on for many years, reclaiming large tracts in the vicinity of the mountains. Tracts entirely barren a score of years ago, after receiving the wash of higher lands, present a scant growth of greasewood, which is succeeded in time by white sagebrush, and that in turn by the ranker growth of blue sagebrush, each step marking an increase of fertility in the soil. Large tracts are found entirely barren of vegetation, others that have advanced to the greasewood stage, still others to the growth of sagebrush. In many places, the transition is evident, and from the testimony of early explorers, certain tracts have completed the entire circuit of increasing fertility within the memory of man. Utah is in the parallel of the Mediterranean, but the elevation renders it more bleak, though not liable to sudden vicissitudes of temperature. The changes in any one winter are quite moderate, but the difference between successive winters is often much greater than in any other part of the United States. Cattle have been wintered in Cache Valley, Ogden Hole, and other sections, entirely upon the range and without shelter. On the other hand, there have been winters in which all the settlements were isolated, when snow fell almost every day, with a high westerly wind, sometimes so high that spray was carried from the lake into the city. The first two winters the Mormons spent in the valley were unusually mild, cattle living along the streams without feed. The third winter, and that of 1854-55, were exceedingly harsh, and the people being unused to make provisions therefore, many hundred cattle perished in the snow. 20 years ago, rain very seldom fell between May and October. In 1860, it continued quite showery, even to the 1st of July, and at present, some rain may be counted on with certainty every month in the season. The change is attributed by one class of philosophers to a gradual change of the rain zones by the Mormons to their prayers and piety and the favor of heaven, but is probably due to cultivation and planting. The same phenomenon is observed in western Nebraska and Kansas and in Upper Egypt. The Indians say, "The pale face brings his rain with him." The summer, as marked by the thermometer, is hot, but the great elevation, the lightness and dryness of the air, the cool winds from the canyons, and the complete absence of malaria render it delightful and wholesome. At the north end of the lake, they have the sea breeze, the mountain air, and the refreshing zephyrs from the plains. During the last summer, the thermometer usually rose 8 or 10 degrees from sunrise till noon. The greatest midday heat was not oppressive, and the mornings and evenings, cooled by the mountain airs, were deliciously soft and pure. The most disagreeable feature of this section is the dust storms and thunderstorms, which during the last season, though not frequent, were severe. Showers are expected when the clouds come from the west and southwest. From the east, they will cling to the hills. Cultivation and irrigation giving greater facilities for evaporation, the process of nature in the cycle of moisture is quickened, the particles of water make the circuit oftener, and more frequent showers are the result. It is evident this climate of cool, dry air in the winter, moderate dryness and extreme tenuity in the summer, and stimulating rarity at all seasons is suited to all healthy and most sickly constitutions. Paralysis is rare, consumption almost unknown. The climate lacks that humidity which develops the predisposition. Asthma and phthisis meet with immediate relief, and from my personal experience, it is evident the air tends to expand, strengthen, and give tonic force to the lungs. But rheumatism and neuralgia are by no means uncommon, as in other bracing climates, they affect the poor and those from any cause insufficiently fed, housed, or clothed during the winter. For all who would avoid humidity, either in soil or air, who seek relief from pulmonary diseases or dyspepsia, the climate is unsurpassed. But for inflammatory diseases, the good effects of this climate are still open to debate.